Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there, and here we go again with Choral Chihuahua, this time on bird. We should just start with a brief apology. We didn't quite get the technical things right this time. The sound is a little bit distant when it's Nicholas speaking. On the other hand, for our authenticity level, it's quite high in that it was recorded in a room off St Paul's Cathedral in London. Not the building Bird would have known, of course, but all the same, fairly echt.
It's a BBC Singers thing.
Welcome to Choral Chihuahua. Today we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Katie Bank, who is a researcher at the University of Birmingham, and Andrew Carland, who is Director of the Cardinal's Music and also Master of the Choristers at St Paul's Cathedral. Welcome both. Thrilled to see you.
Thank you.
We're talking today about Birthday Boy, William Byrd, whose 400th anniversary occurs this year.
Death Day Boy, I'm afraid.
Death Day Boy.
Yeah.
That's put a damn wrong.
Well.
Lovely. Katie, since you've packed up, do you want to tell us a little bit about just his general life and history and his surroundings that he would have worked in?
Yes, well, I'm going to skip his birthday now that you've mentioned it, because that's a subject of much controversy and could be a really boring podcast on... Sorry, it's not boring. A boring podcast on its own. So we'll skip that part and go straight on to perhaps a young bird. He could have been a chorister at St. Paul's Cathedral, as his two older brothers were, but there's no distinct record of Byrd having been a chorister or being educated in music at St. Paul's. However, one can assume or guess that if his two older brothers were, that's a distinct possibility given his eventual line of work. And then he next pops up really in his early 20s when he's appointed organist and Master of the Choristers. I'm not sure if that's the correct title, but at Lincoln Cathedral. I don't know if, Andrew, you want to say anything about that?
Yes, I mean, so he probably wouldn't have been Master of the Choristers because there wasn't a huge amount of mastering of choristers going on. So, I mean, there was somebody would have been responsible, an almoner or someone. But yes, Byrd is appointed as organist. And it's an interesting move, I think, from him. It's obviously a career move because he's been in London. He's had, as you're saying, he's had some education in London. Mm-hmm. He's worked with John Shepherd. We know that because there's a piece that Shepherd and Mundy and Byrd produced together. Must date from the late 1550s and before Shepherd dies. And then he goes right out of London all the way up to Lincoln. And this is where a lot of his English service music, so second service, Preventus O Lord, pieces like that, yeah. The responses will date from. We know he got into a bit of hot water up there because his organ voluntaries were way too flowery. Nobody wants a flowery organ voluntary.
He'd been saying it for years.
So the dean and chapter apparently gave him a little rap across the knuckles.
Do we get a sense of a sort of truculent character or just clergy being clergy?
Interesting, isn't it?
Yes, I think it's a bit of both. You get a sense of an early bird's personality developing, or, you know, who is he going to be? Is he going to be the kind of person who we'll talk about a little bit later, who was constantly in little legal squabbles and, like, fighting with neighbors and was a bit stubborn, perhaps? And you see the beginnings of that person in his years at Lincoln. But also he had a perhaps strict clergy people at Lincoln as well, who wanted things to go a certain way. And eventually they withheld Byrd's pay for about 9 months. But Byrd, you know, in spite of having, you know, a family and a wife, he said, fine, no pay for 9 months before he eventually agreed to just play the notes, the starting notes, for the singers.
It was an aggressive, I think it was an aggressively reformed chapter.
Right.
But yeah. What I, and I've no evidence of this at all, but what I sort of imagine is the young bird's musical brain just overfizzing. You know, I just think, I suspect he sits down to start playing and the ideas just come thick and fast.
Yeah.
You look at some of his later organ music, I mean, some of it's astonishing.
Mm.
And I can imagine him, you know, it all coming out for the first time.
Yeah, we'll come to that perhaps in a bit, the sense of this young man kind of thrustingly advancing his musical personality. What about teachers or education? He was friends with Talis. Is there a royal relationship we can talk about?
Well, there's yes, he certainly seems to be friends with Talis, because when it's the 1575 collaboration and they get this great monopoly on the printing of music. He obviously has a relationship, as I mentioned, with John Shepherd, the great composer who dies in 1559.
He's Oxford-based, is he?
He has been in Oxford, but by this stage he's down in London at St Margaret's Westminster. And William Mundy, the older William Mundy, who appears to have a connection with Westminster Abbey. So this is, and we're back to, we don't know anything about Byrd's early life, but they write a piece together called In Exitu Israel. Shepherd writes four verses, Mundy writes three verses, and Byrd writes three verses. And it's a specific liturgical piece designed for the Easter Vigil, and therefore it must be for Mary's Reformed rite. So it's got to be before 1558.
Right.
And so that's a rather wonderful thing. So you're two young composers and the older composer. So that's obviously had an impact on him. So he's obviously heard the fruits of Mary's restoration, you know, the attempt to rediscover the pre-Reformation music, but in a rather new and glorious and slightly thicker, I would say, style.
Yeah, lovely. Should we have some music? Katie, you've chosen the first track. Do you want to tell us what it is?
Oh, I don't remember what I chose. It's Lord in Thy Wrath. And the recording is by Alamire from their recent recording of the Byrd 1589 Psalms, Sonnets, and Songs. I think that's what the title is. Yeah.
Sounds good. Brilliant. Lovely.
Thank you.
That's O Lord. Oh no, it's not, is it? That's just Lord.
Yes, it's just Lord.
It's just Lord. That's Lord in Thy Wrath, Correct Me Not, by William Byrd, from a disc by Alan Murray, directed by David Skinner. And the singers we heard there were Claire Wilkinson on mezzo-soprano, Simon Wall on tenor,
and with Tim Scott Whiteley on bass.
Now, tell us a bit about why you've chosen that, Katie. It's not, wouldn't be my first choice, but you can explain perhaps.
I think I just feel that Byrd is incredibly good at writing for three voices, and that's something that's really under-discussed and underperformed, under-talked about. I mean, this is the first recording of these pieces, and these, because they're small. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't follow modern tastes to have small little pieces that you could sing with your friends around a table after you've drunk some wine at night, you know? Yeah. That's not what we do today. That's okay, well, that's what my friends do, but we are very niche. You know, so I think it's good to hear this kind of pared down music because you can really follow the polyphonic line. You can hear the words, and you can also kind of imagine, especially in this one voice per part recording, what it would have been like to have that kind of interaction, social interaction. So I think three voice music in general, and you see this with Wilkes as well, is very underperformed, and it has so much merit, so I wanted people to hear it because I think that it's actually quite fun. It can be very beautiful, and you really can hear the craftsmanship in Byrd's writing in a way that perhaps you can't when you're just overwhelmed with luscious texture.
Yeah, lovely. I think we'll come to that a little bit more of that later. But would these have been domestic pieces? I mean, religious text, but are they designed for, as we are, to be sat around a table with a glass of wine, or are they designed for chapel or somewhere else?
Exactly. They're designed to be sung at home amongst your friends in a social setting. And yes, there are psalm text, and yes, it's a religious subject matter, but that's a good thing, right? We want things that are going to kind of warm the spirit and the heart in addition to, be fun and something that's entertaining to do.
Nice. Lovely. Something slightly different. Andrew, we think you're still the only person to record the complete Latin Byrd. So this is now a different personality. Can you tell us a bit about your relationship? How did you come to that project?
Yes. Well, the Cardinals had done a big survey of pre-Reformation music, Ludford and Fairfax and Cornish.
The Cardinals rather than the Cardinals' music?
The Cardinals' music, yes. You mean the baseball team?
That's right.
We'd had a great time doing that, and we wanted to skip forward. We very much liked the idea of doing series. That was very in the days when recording companies were up for all this stuff.
Yeah.
And nobody had done Byrd, and it's so stunning.
Yeah.
That, you know, it was a no-brainer, really. We thought it would just be a wonderful thing to do, to do a survey. So it'd been a huge, huge privilege to do it.
And how many discs does it cover? How long did it take?
So it's 13 discs, yeah. Three of manuscript pieces, and then the publications 1575, 1589, 1591, and the Gradualia interspersed throughout it. And then we did one more disc, because I'm just a tiny bit superstitious, so we did one more disc with a great service and some of the English music, but just a small...
What? Tell me about that superstition.
Well, 13.
Oh, I see.
It's okay.
Well,
if you decide it's Christ...
I thought there was something musicological.
If you decide it's Christ and the 12 apostles, it's all right. But, you know, 13, it's quite a bit old-fashioned these days, isn't it? To say that.
One thing that the Byrd Central followers have been dying to know is, which I kind of guessed the answer to, but why isn't there a box set? And how can you get your hands on that one disc that no one seems to be able to find?
Well, it's very funny you should say that. as you probably know, Hyperion has moved under the umbrella of Universal. And I have been chatting to them, except now means, because half our Byrd series is on ASV,
yep,
which is also went under the Universal umbrella some time ago. And the other half is on Hyperion. So they are now on the same label. I can't, with my hand on my heart, say absolutely definitely, but there are discussions about producing a complete Byrd box set from that series.
There's palpable excitement in the room now.
Watch this space. I would love to do that, just to bring it all together.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit about what you learn from that sort of experience? What you learn about Byrd, of course, about the composer's life and personality, perhaps also about what it takes to make this music successful, I suppose, also to make it sing.
Yeah, I mean, it's to immerse yourself in a composer to this extent is extraordinary, and I'm so grateful to ASV and Hyperion actually for allowing us to do that. And I think the singers loved it as well. I've always had a very text-based approach to my music making. That fits hand in glove with Bird, who I think also has a very text-based approach. So we became very aware. So there's Misericordiam, whatever its ending happens to be. He's talking about mercy all the time. Mm. So many pieces in Felix Ego, all the time it comes up. I think it's a very important word for him. We started to notice various important words. We noticed a big difference of style. So most clearly between, let's say, 1575 or even 1589, the two great collections he's publishing, and the Gradualia, 1605, 1607, I mean, that's a generation apart. Music's moved on. He's absolutely there at the forefront of new music making, new ideas. We see that. I think the two things which shine through for me more than anything else are wit, and that's both rhetoric, you know, how you express not just the individual words in a madrigalian way, but the overarching sentiment, emotion, behind a particular text, I think is that. But also the wit of, as you were just saying, friends making music. You know, it's a conversation, it's a dialogue. And you see that, I mean, at its most extreme, I think, in The Great Service, which I have a bit of a theory about. Which shall I tell you about? Which
I was going to say.
It seems to me Bird is doing a big. I've no historical evidence for this at all. It's never stopped me before. he's obviously doing a big tidy up of stuff. I think 1589, 1591, secular and sacred. There's a lot of stuff going on. We know that he leaves the orbit of London and moves out to Essex, to Stondon Massey, and apart from popping back for the odd Chapel Royal major event, he's basically there in that community. We know that The Great Service is sometime in the 1590s. It's written sometime in the 1590s. It's for 10 voices. That's big. Mm-hmm. There are very few choirs in the country who can sing 10 voice music. In fact, there's probably only one, and that's the Chapel Royal. And I sort of have a feeling this is Bird writing for his mates, saying, you know, I'm off. I'm not going to be coming back. You're not going to see me much again. It's been terrific. This is for you.
Parting gift.
And I just think that the dialogue and the discursiveness and the wit of it, I think, is really, really clear. And I have this sort of feeling, because there's so much to publishing, tidying up, sorting out, going on, that maybe this is his parting gift to his friends at the Chapel Royal.
So I sang it this summer at the Bird Festival in Portland, Oregon with Carrie McCarthy, and we were talking about it after the service, and she was saying how, you know, as a listener, you hear one thing, but then when you're in it with those 10 voices, you there's so much little dialogue and little things that happen across that can, even though that they're separate, and there's so much happening within it that you get a completely different experience of that piece when you're singing it than when you're just listening to it. And I do think that that's pretty true about that piece.
Absolutely true. Yeah, I think it's absolutely true. In fact, Peter Phillips, the director of the Tallis Scholars, always maintains that singers like like Bird and audiences like Tallis. And I don't agree with that entirely, but I sort of know what he means.
Go on.
You feel on the inside, I think, with Bird. You feel as if you're in on... you may not be able to say exactly what it is you're in on, but you're on the inside. He's writing it for you to talk to your friends, for you to sing an interesting line, which has got a quirky rhythm or a particular melodic shape. And it bounces off from one to the other, and it's fun. You have to be in relation with people to do.
Yeah, I think it always feels to me much more like chamber music in the in the kind of more modern sense, doesn't it? Conversations and little in jokes or development of ideas that go somewhere.
And people have to keep in mind that when you're reading things from part books, you have such a different experience of those kinds of conversations, because there's so much more communication that has to happen between singers in order to pull it off, really. Because you know, if you lose your part, you can't just look down at your score and find where the tenors are. You know, you have to trust them, they have to trust you, you have to look up and communicate. And so it's a very different, more communicative way of reading music, I think.
Yeah, let's have some more music. You mentioned In Felix Ego before. Let's just hear it first. We'll hear just an extract from the end, which is, I think, quite good. And then we'll perhaps talk a bit afterwards.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
That was William Byrd's In Felix Ego, sung by the Cardinals Music, directed by Andrew Carwell, who's here with us today. Andrew, tell us about that. It's quite a unique part of Byrd's output, that extraordinary text.
Yeah, the text is absolutely remarkable. It's allegedly written by Savonarola, the great Dominican friar in Florence, who must have been an absolutely terrifying individual, I think. Great, fierce preacher. He rouses the people of Florence against the Medici family, throws them out, and sets up his own regime. And this is all lovely for a little while, but then, of course, being a very devout, more than devout, possibly, you know, overly devout priest, the books start getting burnt, gambling gets banned, various other things get banned. He wants a really upright society, and of course the people rebel against it and bring the Medici back. And then the Medici, rather than having him executed for treason or, you know, some form of treachery, have him executed for heresy. So they get the Pope to do the deed,
it's
and they execute
well connected,
him.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is allegedly the text that he writes on the eve of his death. We do not have an exact thing which says,
okay,
I, Savonarola, am writing this on the eve of my death, but the text is reckoned to be by him. And it's a meditation on Psalm 51. Have mercy on me, O God, the great penitential psalm. Three people set this text. Rore, Cipriano de Rore, Orlando Lassos, Di Lasso, and Byrd. And Rory and Lasso, as you'd expect, are wonderful. They're absolutely lovely. The Byrd is in a totally different league. It's a very personal text. It's a lot of I, me. You know, this is what I feel. This is the situation I am in. It's not removed, as often biblical texts can be. And for me, I think the reason why Byrd responds in a different way is there is a link between Savonarola in Florence, having been discarded by his friends, having been betrayed, if you like, facing death, deprived of his life and his position, and Byrd in England, deprived of his faith, forbidden from openly celebrating the sacraments, the old religion, which is his life, but being denied him and his community. And I think that's why it elicits such a direct, emotional, very, very powerful.
So there's definitely, we sense, like a definite autobiographical tone, if you like.
Well, I think so. If Kerry McCarthy was here, she'd probably say I'm being way too romantic now. But I feel a power behind this, like the surge of the sea. You know, it's, you can listen to, I think Byrd is wonderful, but you can listen to a much more emotionally neutral piece. There are plenty of those. For me, this feels big. It's what I would call a Tudor symphony, in the line of great Tudor symphonies, Vox Patris Celestis, you know, there's tons of Peccavimus, things which take you on a big journey, large in scale, long, so it's about 10 minutes long, in three distinct sections, big scoring, S-A-T-T, Barbie, six voices, divided basses, divided tenors, and it, there's a lot of dialogue, different groups talking to each other. There's a wonderful, it says, like, you know, I dare not look up to heaven. You can almost hear the groups singing it, trying to lift their hand up, like Faustus in Christopher Marlowe's play, when he talks about trying to touch the lifeblood of Christ and running in the heavens. It's, you can hear them doing that and falling, failing to do it. I just find it very immediate and powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, he said it all.
Difficult to follow that.
That is.
Yeah, I just wonder if there's... Is it unique in that sense in Byrd's output? Is it him sort of making a big Catholic statement, or are there other works that do the same or analogous things?
Well, I mean, there are big statements, certainly. I mean, Triboé is a big statement. Ad Dominum is a big statement. There are also less well-known pieces, which are huge. Hic Dicit Dominus, that rarely gets done. There's another piece as well, which I could remember the name of.
Domine Quis Habitavit.
Domine Quis Habitavit is another one.
Even Tristitia.
Deus
Venerunt Gentes.
Absolutely. Descendit Gecenis is the one I was thinking of, in terms of the little known. Just exquisite.
I love that one.
They're talking about him coming down from heaven through the ear of a virgin and going out from the world through a gate of gold. So there are big Catholic statements. Of course, the Gradualia is a big Catholic statement, but it's much smaller scale.
Yeah.
I think it's the the sheer size, the length, the scoring, the power of the ideas that he's got going on, and how he uses them. It makes it for me the most, yeah, almost the ultimate.
Yeah.
Statement.
Lovely. I'm a little bit overwhelmed by that, lovely. Let's think about it. Can we talk about it a bit as singers and what makes it so good to sing? What makes it such good music? Have you got a sense of that?
I think I remember Joseph Kermit in his early days and Edmund Fellowes, they often called Byrd's music archaic.
Are these sort of early editors?
Yeah, these are early editors of Byrd's music from the early to mid-20th century, and Kermit was a bit later, but this was his doctoral thesis, so it was first written in 1950, so, you know, early for him. He came to change his mind about a lot of these things, but, you know, they all called Byrd's music archaic because it was in that quote-unquote older style. And I think when you sing Byrd, you realize how inaccurate that is, because it's not awkward in that older style. It is rhythmically incredibly challenging, and it sometimes comes out of nowhere. You're like comfortably in minims or whatever, and then all of a sudden you've got this little diddly bit that's very important to the cadence, and you know, you turn the page, or you know, you didn't see it coming. And I think as a singer, you realize that there's incredible craftsmanship. No matter what line you're singing, there's no rubbish line. There's no, because he's always thinking contrapuntally. There's never that you know, the alto's the filler kind of situation. It's every line is a gem, really.
Yeah, it's real singer's music too, isn't it?
Oh, I think so. Huge. I mean, we've been in tears sometimes in recording sessions.
Yeah,
because it's just amazing. It's amazing to sing. And I mean, the question, I suppose, one of the questions for me is, if you took the text out and you just sang it all to ooh, would you have the same response? I sort of think you would, actually, because the beauty of the music is so clear. It's this mixture, I think, of beauty and wit, the rhetoric and the beauty. It's very sort of just as well. You know, all the notes are in the right place.
Yeah, you wouldn't change much, would you? You couldn't kind of fiddle with it at all and improve anything. It's that well.
No, it is, and it's interesting when you look at some of the manuscript stuff, which is early, which is clearly early, like the two little Alleluias. A couple of other little four-part pieces where you can see him playing around with stuff, and it's not as great. Yeah. You know, it's early stuff. It's very well written. It's even that in Exeter to Israel that he wrote with Shepherd and Mundy. You say, well, actually, it's a little bit awkward, this phrase. So you can see him learning his craft. But I mean, once he gets the stuff that he chooses to publish, although why he doesn't publish Ad Domino, I'll never know. I don't know why he didn't publish that. Once you get to 1575, I mean, it's just golden all the way through.
It's exciting, isn't it, to watch a composer, to be able to sort of witness historically a composer finding their genius, really, and refining it and finessing it all the time. That's what happens with him.
There's a new book of Byrd scholarship coming out in December that I'm a co-editor of, and one of the chapters is on Similes et Fiant and the In Exit to Israel by Magnus Williamson, who's a professor at Newcastle University. I know you both know. It's great. I don't want to give it away, but it talks about Byrd as an apprentice and what he's doing. And the crux of what he's doing is he's imitating one of his teachers, Shepherd. And he makes a very strong argument for this, in my opinion. And so I'm looking forward to that book coming out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, you also look at the Shepherd a bit and think, that's a little bit ungainly. So I think I'm sure that's what he's doing.
You mentioned Ad Dominum Contribulare. So we'll hear a bit of that. We'll hear the second half of that now. This is probably the one I would choose if I were to choose. It's another eight-part sort of sprawling masterwork. Let's hear it.
Thank you.
That was the second part of Ad Dominum Cum Tribulare with Ifagellini from the 1990s, I think, directed by Robert Hollingworth of this parish. Now, a couple of things about that piece. Let's talk about perhaps the negatives first. We hear a bit of period pronunciation. Do we have any views on that?
Well, I mean, so we do a little bit of period pronunciation. We do consonants. We don't do vowels. We don't change our vowels at all. We stick to a sort of Italian...
You do sing vowels. But
we do sing vowels. We find it's more percussive just to sing the consonants. we do all of the letters. We modify the consonants to fit with what is known. I'm reluctant to change the vowel colour. For several reasons, principally because we don't really know. We can have a jolly good guess. We've got poetry to look at, we've got assonance and various things, but it is guesswork. In terms of what we expect from modern day tuning, I prefer the clarity of the vowels. I also, dare I say, do you think it's unfair of me to say that sometimes it can be a bit comical?
No, absolutely. I think with my academic hat on, I like that there is a recording of it. I like to hear it. I like as an experiment. But as a listener, I find it gets in the way of my enjoyment because I am a modern listener. I am not a period listener. Therefore, I listen with my modern ears.
I think that's exactly right. From a singer's point of view, if I may, it's kind of, it distracts from what's familiar about the music and what's familiar about those texts that you can really get stuck into. And just, I think that you're able to, it gets in the way a bit. I mean, it's not unheard of that it's led to laughter and corpsing, which is highly unprofessional. We don't approve of that.
I've never done that.
No, that's, I can state that's true. But let's talk now about the...
This is my example for how grateful I am that a single book or a single piece of paper, really, or a couple sheets of paper survive, because there's only one source for this motet. It's in the British Library. It's in a big book of In Nomines, which are vial pieces. And it doesn't have any text underlaid. It just has a suggestion of what the text is. So anyone who's editing this piece has to guess where all the words go. And I'm just so grateful that it exists, because if that one thing had been burned or had been mislaid, I mean, it's fun to think about.
Yeah, it's right at the top of, you know, if you do sort of Twitter polls about this kind of stuff, it's right at the top of every single kind of top bird, isn't it? It's really, really...
It's just very, very well written, I think. And posterity has been very kind to us in this case. And as I mentioned before, I'm interested that he chose not to publish it. I mean, it could have been conceived as an instrumental piece anyway. I know there's no such thing as an instrumental piece. It's all, you know, either voices or instruments. But I mean, I just don't understand. And he doesn't publish a Domine Quis Habet Habet either. Maybe pieces in eight parts, or, you know, is too much around 1575. I don't know, but it seems odd to me. That's a piece which is so strong.
He doesn't write that much eight-part music. No. You've got this piece, and then you've got the ones he wrote for in exchange, supposedly with Philip de Monte. But that was particularly in a continental style, and the continental composers were writing in eight part much more frequently, so that was probably a nod to that continental style. So you don't really see Bird writing in eight parts very often, and I think that's another unique thing about this. The other one that I think people often wonder, why didn't he publish this, and perhaps it's for the same reason, is the O Salutaris Ostia 6.
The really naughty one.
The really naughty one, yeah. Which we should have probably picked for this, but we didn't. But everyone can go listen to it on their own.
Yeah, it's very... Well, the first time we sang it, we didn't quite believe that... but of course, it's close. It's a canon.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no doubt. I mean, it's possible he might have regarded this as an early experimental... I mean, we don't know it's early, actually. It's not published. Maybe he just was playing around, you know, what can I do if I do this?
Is it an academic exercise kind of taken to its logical conclusion?
It's extremely powerful and beautiful, I think. Mm. I've even done it here with the choir at St. Paul's, and the choristers were completely blown away by it, because it's so weird.
Well, and those two kind of contrapuntal treble parts are just so beautiful in conversation with each other. I can see why they love it.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about that, Andrew, that you've done this, obviously, this music a lot with the Cardinal's Music, which is a consort, is that fair to say, or a recording group? But obviously you're director here at St. Paul's. Thanks for hosting us today.
It was a pleasure.
Are there differences? Obviously, lots of Bird's music doesn't get done liturgically in a routine fashion, but in terms of the expediency of turnover repertoire, what are the differences between working with those two different groups?
Yeah, I mean, sad to say, very little of Bird's music is done in regular liturgy, especially from the Graduania, and that's partly, of course, because it's conceived for solo voices, and some of the writing is very fast and fiddly, and cathedral choirs tend to be built sometimes for comfort more than speed. But with the cardinals, it's great. You pick the singers that you need. So if you've got one particular scoring, you have one group of singers, and if you've got another one, so you've always got the right people. Your cathedral choir is set. The other difficulty for a cathedral choir is, of course, they have an enormous repertoire. So the repertoire here is vast. So one day the choristers will be singing Stamford and Britten and Mozart, and then they're doing Tanis and Bird. And it's tricky for them sometimes to make that transition. But in terms of, what I think you might mean about the music in the liturgy as opposed to in the concert hall, I've always been very, very keen, and I hope quite clear, that every human being has a spiritual dimension and that needs feeding. And I'm not talking about going to church. It's nothing to do with going to church. But when you encounter this music in the concert hall, you need some context and you need something which allows you to get on the inside, a bit like we're saying the singers are in Bird's compositions, so that you can enjoy it. In the church, of course, you don't need that so much because by the fact you're in the church, you're in a service, you have drama, colour, and the sight of it all, as well as the sound, you are sort of on the inside of it. I would say that here at St Paul's, I probably tend to do the slower pieces. So we do the English music much. I don't do the great service, I'm afraid. I used to, and got a letter from a gentleman after Evensong once who said, "Dear sir, words to this effect, I'm sure you won't see me. Dear sir, I came to Evensong last night. There were no orders of service under the dome. There was no music list. I sat and listened to 10 minutes of utterly impenetrable polyphony, which I could not understand a single word. And could you please not do this again?" And I didn't reply, but I thought about it. I thought, well, actually, he's probably absolutely right. Because that sort of really dense contrapuntal texture does not work well in an 8-second echo.
Yeah.
So I tend to avoid stuff which is heavily polyphonic and imitative in St Paul's. I tend to go to the slightly cleaner ones. So we do the second service and the short service and the English anthems. We do quite a lot of the Latin stuff as well, as much as I can. But I think both is equally valuable. I do think, shorn of its context, and I know I have colleagues in the music world who disagree with this, shorn of its context, its liturgy, its text and its subtext, what it's about, why it's there, I think we appreciate it slightly less. And I am a great believer, when I go to an art gallery, I want to know everything about the paintings that I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember also that a lot of what we think of as church music of Bird's output is not intended for a church setting. A lot of these big Latin, I think, what was the title of Canzone Sacra? It was music in a sacred style or idiom.
That argument is that because of their subject matter.
Because of the subject matter, exactly. Yeah. Yep. Well done. And that's something to remember. So even though there are pieces in that perhaps would be performed liturgically today, they would have been sung perhaps in a more domestic, smaller, kind of amongst elite rich people, basically, in Bird's time. So it's not necessarily meant for liturgy as much as it is for social edification of the soul and the spirit.
Absolutely. And the fact that religion is at the centre of everything.
Yeah.
So we have this idea now that religion belongs in church and doesn't come outside, whereas in the 16th century, religion is everywhere. It's in the air you breathe. So it would not be odd to sing a religious song at the end of a meal and maybe talk about it.
Mm. And that's a really important part of the music that we probably struggle with today to really grasp, isn't it?
Yeah.
Before we finish with the final track, two things I want to just ask you both. Firstly, we talked about this dense polyphonic texture, which is hallmark of so much of music. How does a listener come to that and kind of approach it without being overwhelmed by the kind of virtuosity and knottiness of the texture? And also, I'd like to think a little bit more about Bird and his, to what extent this was kind of clandestine, it almost sounds like a Welsh resort, doesn't it? clandestine music making and the fact that, was this all in secret or is that a bit overplayed in the kind of in the historiography of his life.
So in terms of the texture, the first part of your question, I think one can look to the way he's arranged the English songbooks, 1588, 1589, and 1611, to look a little bit more into how this music would have been consumed by people then, because I think he does it in a few different ways, depending on the publication, but it's either about the number of voices, so three voices, four voices, five voices, and so on, as Tompkins also does for his songbook of 1622, or it's by mood. So I imagine it sort of like a box of chocolates where, you know, maybe you like a few different things, but you're feeling a little bit like, I want the nutty one today, and then I want the caramel one tomorrow, or what's the mood? And you can kind of look at this box of chocolates and these little songs, and you can pick the ones that suit your temperament at that time. And that was actually a very contemporary, early modern way of thinking about how music affects us and how it affects the soul. So you really match the music to your mood, and that's how the music affects you or even changes you. So it could be that you're feeling a bit stroppy, so you go for something even sadder, but somehow that lifts you out of your sadness or your strop, you know. Or you could listen to something happy and that would lift you out. It really depends on the blood type, the planets, the astrology of the individual person.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd have a couple of practical suggestions. So I have a rule here with the choristers here that they can't say they don't like a piece until they've heard it three times, until they've performed it three times. Because we, you know, it's not uncommon for people to hear a piece and they're always dreadful, absolutely awful music. And I don't think anyone would do that with Bird, but it's the business of making friends with it. And you can't do that. We do have especially in this day and age, we have a very quick response time. You listen to a couple of minutes and think, oh, I don't like that, and it goes away. You have to live with it a bit and make friends with it. Exactly like performers.
Yeah. Bird says that. Bird actually says that in one of the English books. He says, you know, you can't judge this until you get to know it.
Yeah,
and I think as performers, that particularly the early stuff we've spoken a little about, that there's that collection of 1575 that he writes with Tallis. Tallis feels like he's a much more mature personality by then, so his stuff is all very spare and very beautiful, economical, kind of approachable. Even as a singer and seeing the music in score, it's absolutely mind-bogglingly sort of intense, isn't it? And actually, yeah, it takes time to make friends with it.
So don't, you know, give yourself some time and listen to it more than once. The other thing is, I think if you have text, it's good to know what the text means. So obviously, if it's in English, it's much easier. You can just sort of, you know, read it on your liner notes or wherever you can get it. But even just knowing what the Latin text means, knowing how the words sound, because I certainly find it helpful when I'm listening to a piece of music. If I recognise the text, if I hear somebody starting with an imitative lead and then there's one over there, it allows you to follow, I think, slightly more easily. And the other thing to say is that, you know, 10-part dense polyphony is quite hard.
It's hard.
To find it hard. And to come back to your point, I think this is where not just the 3-part, but 4-part, 5-part stuff is, especially if it's a bit more homophonic and sometimes, then, you know, get used to that and then get on to the hardcore stuff.
And maybe don't listen to 10-part polyphony in St. Paul's Cathedral.
Never ever, as a health warning, listen to 10-part polyphony.
Chapel Royal, perhaps a little bit more approachable.
You do make sure you write a letter after.
Yes.
Katie, Andrew, thank you so much. It's been really amazing to chat about Bertie. You both know so much and such enthusiasm. And let's have one last track, which I think we should have, O Salutaris Hostia, which we mentioned earlier, which is, well, does one of you want to sort of describe that a little bit to us before we prepare our ears for it?
Oh, wow. Gosh, I don't want to give the game away.
Yeah.
It's got various canons going on. So that's when one part is singing a tune and another part replicates that tune exactly usually at a different pitch. It can be at the unison, at the octave, but at the fourth or the fifth. And so we know it's right. I think I would just leave it there. Every note that you're about to hear is incorrect. Nothing has been incorrect.
It's correct.
That's really, it's going so well.
We didn't even get to the E sharp and Civitas.
That is a big one. What was I saying? So yes, we know therefore that every note that you're going to hear is correct. There is nothing wrong. Your eyebrows may
do not adjust your sets.
Go up. Do not adjust your sets. Just strap in and
you'll be okay.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Oh,
Oh, never have so many false relations been gathered together in one motet. The Fichter Police are all over that. Singing was the Marian Consort, directed by Rory McCleary, and also dropped into this episode we heard part of the Great Services Magnificat, sung by the Odissean Ensemble, conducted by Colm Carey, who's also the master of the music at the Tower of London. And from that same recording, the Fantasia BK62, a bit of it anyway, Christian Wilson on organ. Fantastic to get insights from people who live and breathe Byrd. I've worked with Andrew on occasion, and I was always struck by his unfussy attitude to vocal production. This is quite rare in early music vocal ensembles. His focus was always on the text, the point of the text as well, whether it was devotional or liturgical. I couldn't help noticing that all three contributors trashed the concept of period pronunciation, so perhaps we'll hear the other side of that argument another time. See you then.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or, if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.